This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 58th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me today John Savage. Hi, John.
Hi, Gary.
John Savage is a professor of computer science at Brown. He's also a Jefferson Science Fellow for the State Department. Dr. Savage has been piling up the laurels since earning his PhD at MIT in 1965, a year before I was born. He joined Bell Labs in 65 and the faculty of Brown in 67. In 1979, he co-founded the Department of Computer Science, which he chaired from 1985 to 1991. John has deep roots in theoretical computer science and also computational nanotechnology. He's a fellow of the ACM, an IEEE Life Fellow, and a Guggenheim Fellow. He's a recipient of a Fulbright Hayes Research Award, and he's also written three books, the latest being Models of Computation. John lives in Providence, Rhode Island, and spends too much time in Washington, D.C. So, John,
not true.
As a studied computer scientist and theoretician, what is your frank assessment of the state of cybersecurity as a discipline?
Well, as a discipline, it seems to me it's, 25 or 30 years old, it's still in its early stages. Academics don't teach many courses in this area. There are a few places that do. The first course on computer security was taught at Brown just a couple of years ago by one of my colleagues, Roberto Tomasia. I would say that we really have a long way to go. The problems are very hard. They are intellectually very challenging, and they have great practical importance.
So plenty of work remaining to be done.
Tremendous amount of work.
I would agree with you. You know, I got into computer security in 1995 after getting a PhD in computer science and cognitive science, and I was sort of appalled at the state of the field. I think we've made a lot of progress since then, but not enough.
Oh.
So you served as a Jefferson Science Fellow to State in 2009, which I believe has a four-year tail as well of consultation.
Yes.
What issues are top of mind at State when it comes to cybersecurity and other cyber issues?
Well, the State Department's role, as you know, is not to deal with, solve the problem of cybersecurity. Their role is to represent the interests of the United States abroad, not only through its embassies, but through standards bodies. But they have to establish policy. So they work hand in glove with other agencies of the federal government under the coordination of the Cybersecurity Coordinator's Office to formulate policy. That process has been underway for some time, but it picked up steam last year, late in 2009, picked up steam in 2010 and is continuing apparently at a good clip.
And that steam is around setting the right sort of policy, thinking about these
setting
issues?
Setting policy, right. And there is a process that the Cybersecurity Coordinator's Office established before Howard Schmidt joined, which is to create a set of committees, what they call interagency policy committees. And I sat on one of those for almost a year, and it was fascinating.
What do you think about the technical background knowledge that the policymakers are bringing to this question? Do they seem to understand what it is they're supposed to set policy about, or is it sort of magic to them?
Oh, it's not magic. The people I dealt with in the Cyber Affairs Office are very intelligent people who are quick studies, and they have been able to, either before or during their tenure, come to grips with cybersecurity issues from a depth of knowledge so that they can handle the policy issues. Now, admittedly, the policy issues that they've been addressing so far have not been have not dealt with profound issues. For example, I think the BGP trust issue is profound.
Right.
It's very important. And they don't have not understood this problem because it hasn't come to their attention.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, you know, when I was a Jefferson Science Fellow, I was invited to give a distinguished lecture in the State Department. And that was given in the Marshall Auditorium, which is a very big auditorium. I had a large audience of people there. It was fascinating. But one of the points that I made then, which I still profoundly believe in, is that you need to have technologists and policymakers at the table at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being that there are technological solutions which are unknown to the policymakers, which if they understood them might result in a different set of policies that would be established. And secondly, the policymakers, as they confront issues that are challenging, they can turn to the technologists mm-hmm. and they can ask for advice. They can try to encourage them to find solutions. Solutions don't come quickly, of course. But I think both can benefit. We can be much more effective working together.
You know, I completely agree with that. I've been good friends with Ed Felton from Princeton. We wrote mm-hmm. a couple books together long ago, and I'm psyched to see him get more involved with government and the policymakers with his position now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I also think he's completely crazy, as are you.
Well, I did it for a year. From August of 2009 to August of 2010,
uh-huh.
and it was a very interesting experience. I became very passionate about cybersecurity. I haven't actually written any papers in the area yet, but mm-hmm. who knows, I might someday. But what I am doing that's very interesting and you may want to ask me about is I'm teaching a course starting at the end of January on cybersecurity and international relations.
Yeah, I saw that. We will get into that a little bit later.
Okay.
Before then, I wanted to ask you whether you think it makes sense to form military units in cyberspace as a reaction to our worrisome dependency and systematic vulnerability.
The short answer is yes. You're talking about Cybercom?
I suppose Cybercom and you know the notion of defending this broken thing that we've built.
I think this is unavoidable. Nations around the world, it's said to be at least 20 nations, are preparing for cyber conflict. And it's unavoidable. And I think everybody has to sharpen their offensive and defensive weapons. But the thing that disturbs me about this is that there's a rush to militarize cyberspace,
mm-hmm.
when in fact cyberspace should be treated the way the radio spectrum has been treated, and telecommunications in general has been treated.
As a common, so to speak.
As a common. Tony Rutkowski, who is used to be at the FCC and now works for a corporation whose name escapes me in the D.C. area, has written about this. He wrote a piece on the first cyber war,
mm-hmm.
which he describes as the conflict that emerged early in the 20th century when there were disputes over use of the radio spectrum. And in fact, he said that, I think it was President Roosevelt signed an agreement in 1912, if I'm not mistaken. That was signed just after the Titanic went down, because apparently the sinking of the Titanic, The fact that we couldn't get to the Titanic was due to the fact that the standards we used, and this is my inference from what he said in
mm-hmm.
his piece,
mm-hmm.
was due to the fact that the standards used for telegraph communications were different in Europe than they were in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the nations around the world decided, let's not fight over this space, let's partition it, let's agree on standards. Later, this was done through an organization that eventually became the International Telecommunications Union.
Mm-hmm.
So, personally, I think we should, I don't think we can ever demilitarize cyberspace, but I do think that we should invest very large efforts to reduce risks, to reduce tension, and if we can, we should try to demilitarize it. But I think it may be beyond that now.
Yeah. Well, I think that your notion of cyber peace that you laid out in the paper that you wrote with Les Bloom kind of articulated that vision.
It does.
And I kind of like the idea of talking about cyber peace instead of cyber war.
Right.
It doesn't have the same sex appeal, though.
No, it's because people love, as you said, I think, in some an interview of your own, that you wrote two books, and one on hacking has gotten a lot more sales. You've got a lot more sales with that book than you have on the cybersecurity.
Yeah, I call it the NASCAR effect.
Well, people do like to see a crash.
They
right?
do.
Crashes are exciting.
Yep. Yeah, that's why there's no Volvo Car Safety Channel.
But I think we have to raise the alarm here. You know, this we have to bring this to the attention of the public. The public has to understand that these problems are real, serious, and they can have a tremendous impact overnight on our economy. It's really the economy that's at risk here,
mm-hmm.
more than anything else. Because
I think there's also personal liberty at risk. You know.
Oh yes.
So that's true. if we get technical for a sec, or slightly technical, you know, there are very important tensions between modern systems for attribution based on cryptography
sure.
and individual
sure.
liberty in an open society. And what are your thoughts about sure. that?
Well, I think you need in cyberspace both secure authentication methods, and you need anonymity as well. You need a form of eCash. I have a colleague here, Anna Lishinskaya, who's done research with Jan Kamenisch at IBM. They have patents in this area of anonymized commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to have anonymity. But if you're going to be dealing with corporate secrets, with government secrets, you do need to be able to authenticate yourself over these insecure networks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mixture of both, I think.
It is a mixture of both. You know, of course, some people want to push attribution so far as to completely get rid of the possibility of anonymity. So we have to keep that in mind as well.
It's never going to happen. Yeah. The public would object to that. I don't think it's prudent.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So, you know, towards the end of this notion of data leakage and IP stealing and all this stuff, you know, mm-hmm. WikiLeaks is top of mind right now.
Right.
In your view, is WikiLeaks part of the press that should be protected by the First Amendment, or is it some sort of a new beast, or is it in fact a terrorist organization, as some politicians have said?
Well, I would be cautious about declaring it a terrorist organization, because if you did that, then you'd have to accuse the New York Times, among other respectable outlets, as having trafficked with terrorists.
I think some people would like to do that, actually.
So, no, I don't think it's a terrorist organization. The thing that has interested me about this is there are two things. One is that PFC Bradley Manning is the primary culprit here.
Right.
All right. But number two, one should ask, were adequate controls put on the databases which he used to access the documents that he was able to exfiltrate?
Exactly. I mean, you know, nobody was paying attention that everything from CipherNet was being stuck on a USB drive. Hello?
I know. That's the issue, you know. And to me, that is such an obvious mistake
yeah.
to allow someone to do this without being monitored.
Yeah.
There should have been controls on the volume and the number of items per day a person could download.
Some sort of velocity checking stuff we know about
yes,
from
exactly.
computer science. Yeah.
You know, it's the presumption, I guess, has been that it's been difficult to copy paper documents, and the same would apply in cyberspace, which we know is a joke.
Yeah, that would be wrong. So I want to push on the cyber war thing just a little bit more.
Sure.
The dogs of cyber war are on the hunt, and we seem to either be in danger of a cyber arms race or of destroying our glass house with a cyber rock. So why do you think that the cyber warriors in the DoD and the intel community especially, who are separate and distinct from the people at state and the people in the executive branch, focus all of their attention on offensive weaponry these days?
Well, I mean, you're making an assertion here that it's the intelligence community that's focusing on offensive weapons. Is that correct?
I think the intelligence community is focusing on offensive weapons for espionage, and the DOD is focusing on offensive weapons for warfare.
I would agree with that. Now, I have spent only 1 year in the government, so I'm not an expert on what I'm about to say, but I do have the impression that the role of the military, their role, which is sanctioned, which we want them to play, is to protect the nation.
Right.
So, and these folks tend to bring the best and brightest minds to play in that task. They work hard at it. They are proactive. So if you are proactive, you are going to get access to the best minds, and you're going to confront a brand new challenge. Then what you're going to do is you're going to prepare for the possibility of attack, and you certainly are also going to prepare for defense.
So I've seen much more preparing for offense than defense just from my own chair, you know, in my discussions with the guys that are running those things. And that worries me, because I agree that you need to focus on both.
Well, let me say this, that if they are doing superbly in defense, they won't tell you. If they understand how to defend against intrusions, they won't tell you.
Well, that's not secret. I'm not thinking about operational defense of the sort that we, I think, overfocus on. You know, I think policymakers are paying a lot of attention to reactive threat reduction centers and CERTs and the things that you talk about in some of your writings, rather than building things properly and security engineering and not having a bunch of broken stuff that we're trying to defend. And I think that that's a rather fundamental mistake.
Well, it is. And it's partially because they don't understand the technology. And they don't know what options exist at the technology level. And number two, all the conversation is about when there is public conversation or lecturing to the public, it is you follow best practices.
Right,
keep
which
your
is a little
software
vague.
Up to date. Right. But they don't, here's what is missing in this picture, and that is we as users of software systems cannot repair them.
Right.
We can't even tell if they're broken. We can't tell if they've been penetrated, generally. So who should be responsible for this?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me it has to be the people who sell us these products.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the common practice, as we both know, is that when you acquire a piece of software or hardware, you sign a license that says the vendor is not responsible for anything.
Right.
And that has to change.
Yeah.
Not overnight, but it has to change.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So back to the cyber war thing for another second. Assume that Stuxnet was a product of a nation state. That's a pretty big assumption, but let's just assume that. Do you think that the use of such a cyber weapon is morally justified?
Is morally justified.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's as morally justified as an attempt to sabotage a piece of equipment, physical equipment that is being, you know, is going to be acquired by an aggressive competitor nation.
Yeah, an enemy regime, I would say.
An enemy regime.
Yep. I agree. Now a total flyer. Mm-hmm. So what implications do nanotechnology especially computational nanotechnology that you've been working on for quite a while, have for cybersecurity?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. On the surface, I would say none, except for the fact that as we make our components smaller, as the feature sizes go down, we put more components on a chip. Mm-hmm. This does give us some scope to change the way in which we write code and the way in which we implement chips. For example, in the past, field programmable gate arrays would have been seen as very expensive, mm-hmm. and so vendors wouldn't use them. They would use ASICs, or they would do their own design using CAD tools. In the future, they will have more real estate available, and as they do, I think for security reasons, they should start changing the way in which they write code. They should put some monitoring on their chips so that they can monitor intrusions, unusual activity using components that are not part of the rest of the chip, so they can't be tampered with. Mm-hmm. Today we incorporate drivers into our operating systems. So you have a company like Microsoft that will produce an operating system. They'll run a whole battery of tests to make sure that there are no buffer overflow attacks, heap overflow attacks, and a whole bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. They use managed memory, which is, I have a son who works at Microsoft, and he tells me that he's able not only to write code much faster, but it's much more secure code. Mm-hmm. As we know from the published reports, Panda Labs and other places, the number of major updates that Microsoft has had to do has gone down relative to the competition.
Yeah, Microsoft is one of the firms in a BSIM study and mm-hmm. An important right. leader in the software security space.
They are indeed.
So I agree with you. They've made some progress. And you think some of that will find its way into hardware?
Well, I think it could. I mean, but they still incorporate drivers developed by others
That's
into
true.
Their upgrades.
That's right. NVIDIA is
a security
big giant problem.
Right. So they do it, why? For efficiency reasons, correct? These drivers can be put in, I think, in the user space. Mm-hmm. So why aren't they? One can ask that they take steps like that. Mm-hmm. They've implemented address space layout randomization.
Yep.
Data execution protection.
Yep.
Those are important steps, but they can be subverted, as we know.
Yep, and sometimes they get skipped in various applications.
That was
the subject of a
right.
conversation I had with Yvonne Arce in an earlier episode.
Yes, that's right. I recall reading that. And, that's because they're incompatible with. So fix the code, right? Rewrite the code. My point is, as we both know, security is not free. You have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it, coming back to the nano point, if you have more components in a chip, you have more latitude there to exploit a whole variety of techniques to make your software and make your systems more robust.
I have another kind of a flyer question for you as a
sure.
as a theoretician. So I think it's kind of ironic that we spend a lot of effort to come up with a universal computational device, a universal Turing machine, mm-hmm. so to speak, and then we get all upset when it does some of the things that, of course, it is allowed to do by theory.
Right.
And the question is, why don't we just have special purpose machines that can't do everything? That would seem to help from
most
a
part,
security perspective.
Right. Well, a good programming practice is, I'm sure you know and probably have in your book, is if you can write a piece of code that implements a finite state machine, do it.
Right.
Right?
It's called,
okay.
it's part of the principle of least privilege, sort of an axiom to that.
Right. So, yes, you should. But see, the Turing machine is we need expressiveness, and almost any good programming language is Turing complete.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all the power of Turing machines there, which I think is unavoidable, unfortunately.
Right.
And it's not that the Turing machine was invented so that it would create the problems.
No.
It's just that seems to be the Church Turing thesis is that this is the most general model of computation that we've ever invented.
Right. And once you turn it to 11, it's hard to step it back down to 5.
Right.
The crowd doesn't go wild.
No.
Okay. And then, you know, the candy question. So what's the best piece of fiction that you've read recently?
Best piece of fiction? I don't read fiction.
Oh.
I tend to be, in some ways, I tend to do, my reading tends to be technical, policy-oriented these days. I've been doing a tremendous amount of reading for my course in the spring. Oh, I did read the girl with the tattoo.
The dragon tattoo, yeah.
Dragon tattoo, yes. I read that this summer.
That's definitely
only volume one, only the first book in the series. I understand that she is quite a geek, and the later books are supposed to be interesting, so I decided I should read them, but I haven't read them yet.
All right, well, we'll let you answer what's the most interesting nonfiction thing that you've read lately.
Well, I will tell you that there one nonfiction idea that I think is most interesting and potentially, although not yet, exciting, is this solution to the crypto computing problem due to Craig Gentry, which is fully homomorphic encryption.
Hmm.
You know about that?
I don't.
Oh, well, you and your readers must know about this. This is absolutely essential. What Craig Gentry has shown in a paper published in a stock conference in May of 2009 is that it is possible to encode data so that when you compute on the data, it remains encrypted.
Hmm.
And you never have to decrypt until you bring the results home.
Hmm.
And his technique for doing it is very intellectually very challenging. There's been a piece on this in the Communications of the ACM that he wrote, and there was an overview piece that someone else wrote on the subject. It's actually very fascinating. Right now, it's extraordinarily inefficient, his techniques.
Right.
But they have potential to eventually make cryptography, to extend cryptography to computation. The reason why it doesn't normally extend is because whenever you do a multiplication, typically, when you do addition, you can keep data encrypted, but you can't do both. It's very difficult to do both addition and multiplication on encrypted data. In other words, provide a way to encrypt so that when you do either addition or multiplication, think of addition as or, and think of multiplication as and, that you can preserve, you can produce an output which can be put back into the same code that was used to encode the data before you did the operation.
Right, right, yeah. That would do a lot for DRM,
yes,
among other things.
But, yes, it would, but it's right now impractical to use.
So we'll dig up the URL and stick it on the website.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, super. Thanks very much. Yeah. This has been great.
It's been a pleasure as well, Gary. Nice talking to you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P features a roundtable discussion of cloud computing and security with representatives from Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Cisco, and the Cloud Security Alliance. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.